In our second case, 2023-0975, Jennifer Ackman, personal representative and administrator of the estate of Janet Solman versus Mercy Health West Hospital and Mohammed Raz Ahmad and Hospitalist Physicians of Ohio. On behalf of the appellant, Mr. Sesta. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the courts. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. We are here today to ask the court to adopt a rule that the Civil Rule 12b-4 and 5 service defenses are waived when a defendant actively litigates a case. We think that this case presents a perfect illustration of why this rule would be important and should be adopted. We believe that where a defendant timely files an answer to a complaint, litigates the matter for over 2 years, attends case management conferences, depositions, written discovery, and then doesn't file a motion to dismiss that could be decided without prejudice, but rather files a motion for summary judgment after they have run out the statute of limitations, file a motion for summary judgment with prejudice, allowing res judicata to attach.
Counsel, there was an entry in the docket indicating that service had not been perfected. Isn't that correct?
So that is true. I would, Justice Donnelly, I would point the court to the affidavit of trial counsel that was attached to the response to the motion for the memo in opposition to the motion for summary judgment. Trial counsel didn't receive that notice.
Was it in the answer? That insufficient service?
Yes, Justice Fisher.
In Gliazzo, didn't we write the majority 6-1 case that proper avenue to change this would be through a rule change?
Yes, and I would like to address that.
Has there been a rule change?
No, Your Honor, there's not been a rule change. What there has been, though, the change that has occurred since Gliazzo is, one, we've seen our federal Sixth Circuit adopt a rule in King v. Taylor that the service defenses are waived through conduct of a defendant.
Without changing the language of the rule itself?
Each time the court has to make a separate decision based upon the specific facts of each case.
Well, so while it would be a case-by-case analysis, that's true, Justice Fisher. What I would note for the court is I don't believe this would result in some sort of flood of litigation where the trial courts are going to have to sort of parse through this determination. What I suspect strongly would happen is as soon as this court were to overturn, if this court were to overturn Gliazzo, immediately defendants would no longer have the incentive to attempt this, right? You would file, if a defendant truly and sincerely believes that they have a service defense, they can file it as a motion to dismiss without prejudice, right? That way we get right back to plaintiff can refile. The whole goal is to try to find merits decisions, right?
Let me ask counselor. So in the answer, as an affirmative defense was insufficient service, correct?
Among the 23 paragraphs of affirmative defenses, yes, Your Honor.
All right, so that was one of them. And the docket never indicated that there was sufficient service, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
So at any point during this litigation, when both sides were actively participating, let's say 3 months down the road, could you have then served the defendant?
It's true that service could have been reattempted. That is correct. I do believe, pretty clearly the intent of what was happening, right? Defendant files an answer and then just sits on the defense for 2 years participating in the litigation. I mean, at a certain point, I think the court should find that the defense has been waived at that point. It would just, I'm sorry.
Well, and I get what you're saying, and I understand your argument that it was disingenuous to participate all this time, and then once statute of limitations ran, say, oh, you know, here's our ace in the hole. But also, you were aware, you were either aware or should have been aware that service was not perfected such that they could possibly do this down the road.
So that is, it is correct. Yes, Justice Stewart, it is correct that this was a thing that counsel could have discovered. Nevertheless, I mean, I think what I would get back to, I mean, it's the proper vehicle for advancing this would be a motion to dismiss. The entire spirit of the civil rules is to result in decisions on the merits. This is a game that a defendant can play to get out of trial, never have to defend themselves on the merits, and I don't.
And wasted think everybody's time, the courts, and it wastes.
It wastes the trial.
So let me ask you this scenario. Oftentimes, yes, when litigation begins, especially when you're dealing with corporate entities, the plaintiff's counsel will, especially when you've got an insurance company representing both parties on the defendant's side, the plaintiff's counsel will, of learning that maybe there was a lack of service to one, or maybe not even waiting for it, say to opposing counsel, will you waive service? If opposing counsel says, no, my client's not going to let me do that, or just they're going to be obstreperous and just say no, period, without checking with their client, there'd be efforts then made to try to perfect service. What if the defendant was rather dodgy? Could the trial court, as things stand right now, ever say there's service and I'm going to call it?
Justice Bruner, it's an interesting question. I don't think at the current state of the law, I don't think the trial court would have that authority. Under Glioso, I don't think the trial court has the ability to cause, if I understand the hypothetical, I don't think the trial court would have the authority to cause the defendants to waive service. I mean, I think we're stuck in the land of Glioso, and the only way to obviate that is overturning the.
But let's say we did what you asked us to do, which was to overturn Glioso, then the scenario would be that the trial judge could call it, and then the question of whether or not there'd been enough contacts in the litigation for there to be service, if we don't get into some of the other things about deciding which type of case we're applying it to, then that would be reviewable by a court of appeals and ultimately by this court as well.
Yes, Justice Bruner, absolutely correct. And it does raise the question of sort of what would be the appropriate time frame for that to be asserted. There is some federal precedent to indicate the appropriate time would be look to the end of the service period that's provided in the civil rules, right? Ohio Civil Procedure Rule 4E provides after the plaintiff files a complaint, there's a six-month service period. So we would look for a decision from this court. We would be requesting, okay, after that six-month wait period, right, that's the trigger at which the defendant should be timely asserting their defense, or they've waived it. So I think that provides.
In sorry. This case, the defendant filed, pursuant to rule, a timely answer?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. So the defendant was in the appellee's brief. They made clear the defendants, so the doctor, Dr. Ahmad, and the practice hospitalist, they had same counsel. They were represented by an insurance company, right? And so they filed a joint answer. Mm-hmm. Hospitalist, the practice, had been served. The doctor had not. They filed the joint answer, and then that's the procedural posture for this case.
Do you think this is a result of the culture of litigation where defense lawyers just put in everything in the kitchen sink about list of affirmative defenses, and it's just become such the practice that no one assumes that they intend to assert half of those or more?
Justice Donnelly, I do think that is a part of what's happening here. And then in addition to it, I mean, look, from the defense side, the idea of you've got this ace in your back pocket and you can sit on it for until the statute of limitations runs and then you pull it out and then boom, you're out of the case and you win.
But wouldn't it be different if you weren't put on notice that they had this in their back pocket?
I'm sorry, Justice Stewart, by notice, you mean?
You're saying so they have this in their back pocket and they sit on it until it's strategically convenient to then put it forth, but it's not that it was hidden.
Well,
at any one of the pretrial conferences that you had, someone could have served it.
Yes, Chief Justice. Now, my thought though is that this is the defendant's defense, right? It shouldn't
put on notice of the affirmative defense. It was documented, to Justice Fisher's point. So once you had notice of it, you could have proceeded with serving, and then the affirmative defense is gone.
So Chief Justice Kennedy, I think this gets to Justice Donnelly's point, though, that, I mean, you've got, in this particular answer, you've got 23 different affirmative defenses asserted. I'm not sure it's just like the standard trial practice at this point of.
So lawyers no longer pay attention to the documents that they receive in response to a litigant, whether that's an answer or an interrogatory or anything else. It's totally irrelevant.
No, Your Honor. Okay. No, I'm not.
I have to say I read Judge Bergeron's dissent in pushing for the federal rule. He didn't mention that under the federal rule, you can actually pre-serve, in effect, a defendant and ask for a waiver, right? And then you have regular process after that, correct?
Sure.
You know, so it's a different process, procedure, in federal court than in state court. Is it not?
Well, what I would say, Justice Fisher, while there may be another mechanism for service.
I used to get them in the mail and send them out all the time.
We're still dealing with the same. I mean, the civil rules are identical as far as the 12B, 4 and 5 defenses, whether state or federal. The 12H1 language is identical for
We're talking waiver. About Rule 4, right? Service.
Right. Sure.
And the system of service in the federal courts is different than in the state court, correct?
It's different in that there's an extra avenue, but I don't think that takes away from sort of the core point of, I mean, the entire goal, right? The entire system of justice that we have is we're looking for decisions on the merits, not on procedure, right?
And the burden's on the plaintiff, though, to initiate the lawsuit.
The burden is on the plaintiff to initiate the lawsuit.
So they should serve.
And then after sufficient participation, I mean, at what point is it clear that what defendant has perpetuated here is it's a game to get out of a case procedurally,
right? Defendant agreed to a deposition in this case, correct, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And agreed to comply with court orders to comply with discovery, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And let's say they didn't do that intentionally, you would have filed a motion to hold them in show cause in contempt, right? If they didn't show up for a deposition?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then they would have this ace in the hole that no one knew about, or that your side didn't know about at least, that would have told the court, you can't hold me in contempt because this action hasn't been commenced, right?
I think that's a reasonable assumption of how it would play out, yes.
So that's not the policy behind service, right? The policy behind service is to give the other side notice so they can defend themselves.
The entire point of due process, yes, Justice Donnelly, notice and an opportunity to be heard on the merits, which is exactly what we're requesting happen.
Civil Rule 1B says these rules shall be construed and applied to effect just results by eliminating delay, unnecessary expense, and all other impediments to the expeditious administration of justice. So you still think that Glioso is the stumbling block or the obstacle in the way to applying this in your client's case?
Absolutely correct. Yes, that is our position, Justice Bruner.
And you've given that to us as a sort of an underlying rationale for why we should overrule Glioso.
That's correct. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Yep. Yep. And if I can reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Ms. Long.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Karin Long, and I represent the appellees in this case, Dr. Ahmad and Hospitalist Medicine Physicians of Ohio.
Ms. Long, what's the purpose of service?
The purpose of service is to both protect a defendant's due process rights to notice and an opportunity to be heard and to commence the suit in Ohio.
So of those three things you stated there, the first two are, there's no question. The defendant's rights, opportunity to be heard, that all happened.
In this case, Your
in
Honor?
This case?
The record does not reflect the level of notice that Dr. Ahmad had in this case.
Was the defense proceeding on behalf of Dr. Ahmad in the hospital?
They were. In the affidavit that Dr. Ahmad submitted with the motion for summary judgment, he stated he was aware that he was a defendant, but that he never received a copy of the summons and complaint.
Was the answer on behalf of Dr. Ahmad and the hospital?
It was, Your Honor.
Okay. And so you're saying the suit did not commence, although there was defense representation throughout?
Correct, Your Honor. The suit did not commence because there was not service within the 1 year given. There was no 41A to give more time to serve. There
so
was
why
no
why did you extend all this legal work to the financial detriment of your client?
Well, whether it's to the financial detriment of the client depends on the different strategies before them. So in the challenge to the motion for summary judgment, the plaintiff appellants did challenge service and say this was adequate, this was reasonable. That is why defense counsel has to hedge their bets and answer in case there is a challenge to service. If there's no service whatsoever, they don't need to answer. But in most cases like this, there will be a challenge and an argument that there was service. So they have to hedge their bets. They have to file the Rule 26 discovery. They have to attend case management conferences. If they filed this motion within the first year that 3A gives to commence the suit, it would not be ripe yet. And after that point, it becomes an analysis, what's in the best interest of the defendant to file a motion at what point? What kind of motion? A 12B motion, a motion for summary judgment on the merits? It becomes a balancing for the defendant, and they act in their best interest.
Well, if a motion to dismiss were filed and not granted, couldn't that same argument still be brought in a motion for summary judgment?
It could, Your Honor, but to your point, that's to the financial detriment of the client. They're weighing the possibility that it will not be granted, and they may choose not to put their resources toward a motion which they believe will not be granted.
So did Dr. Ahmad request a jury trial?
I believe he did, Your Honor. I believe the answer on behalf of Dr. Ahmad and the company did request a jury trial.
But we can surmise that he requested it, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Do you think that all the officers of the court have the responsibility when it says these rules shall be complied in Civil Rule 1B and applied to effect just results by eliminating delay and all their impediments to expeditious administrative of justice? So maybe it would be advantageous to Dr. Ahmad to wait and bring this up until after the statute of limitations had run to refile. But do you think that counsel have to kind of pay attention to Civil Rule 1B too?
Counsel does have to pay attention to Civil Rule 1B, seek not to waste the court's resources, the time, the expense, and that's why the plaintiff should serve the defendant within the 1 year they are given to commence their suit, or they should choose to utilize 41A to dismiss until they can reserve them.
But in the meantime, I think Dr. Ahmad participated in three status conferences. Would he be required to be there so he could be served?
He was not required to be there, but service wasn't raised there. It certainly could have been.
But you couldn't have served, I mean, his counsel couldn't have served you. That wouldn't have sufficed, correct?
I believe counsel can accept service in this scenario on behalf of their client, so that would be one option. Another option, if they realize they had the wrong address, would be interrogatories. If they could not get resident service or business service, service by publication is something that's commonly used, and that's a manner reasonably calculated to give notice, and at that point, the plaintiff has fulfilled their duty.
Thank you.
Counselor, if this motion for summary judgment were denied, litigation continued, you decide to appeal after the litigation for whatever reason, maybe a finding in favor of plaintiff, you appeal, and you bring as one of your assignments of error, the trial court erred in not granting your motion for summary judgment based on this issue of service. Is the analysis the same there as it is in this case before a final judgment?
I believe it would be the same, Your Honor. I think the only difference is that you would not have the opportunity for an interlocutory appeal if the motion for summary judgment
right, that's
denied,
what I'm saying. During conclusion of the case and there was a judgment in favor of plaintiff, would you use as one of your assignments of error, because you do have to wait for the litigation to continue, because it's not a final appealable order, denial of the motion for summary judgment, would the Court of Appeals analysis be the same post-judgment as it was in this case on a motion for summary judgment?
I do believe the analysis would be the same, although I would note that in most cases, including Gliazzo, the proper procedure would be to kind of re-up that motion during trial and again move the court to dismiss or for summary judgment, and then that would be more properly appealed than the motion that had been denied. That's the procedure that typically happens, and then the analysis has been the same.
And so what you'd be saying is, yes, we've litigated this case, yes, we've come to a final judgment, but the case never really began.
Yes, Your Honor, just as if the statute of limitations was appealed after the judgment or any other issue, there's always the opportunity on appeal for the case to be flipped on its head, even though effort has been put in to litigate it.
But was your client denied due process in this case?
Well, due process requires service of the summons and complaint.
No, it requires notice.
It requires notice through the mechanism of service in a manner reasonably calculated to apprise them of the suit. And in this case, Dr. Ahmad was denied that opportunity. In terms of whether actual notice should be a substitute for service, there's a number of major issues with that holding. First of all, there are the cases where it may appear that a defendant had notice, but they didn't. And then they have the actual harm that comes with the deprivation
of due
process.
Excuse me for interrupting, but he participated in depositions and actually took a deposition of the plaintiff, correct?
Dr. Ahmad did. And in this case, the court did not analyze what notice Dr. Ahmad had and when he had it. That's a fact question that would arise in every single case if Gliazzo were overturned. More broadly, there would be cases under the appellant's rule where it may appear that the defendant had notice because counsel was litigating on their behalf, but they did not have actual notice, and that deprivation of due process would be a real harm that they suffer.
But looking at this particular situation, and we're not looking at a contract situation, we're looking at a tort situation, there was extensive participation in the litigation process before the motion for summary judgment was filed, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, there was participation in discovery before the motion was filed.
Well, no, there was three different status conferences. There were depositions, and there was an answer. I mean, what did Dr. Ahmad not get as far as he didn't get that summons, but did he miss out on any of the litigation because he didn't get the summons?
It would really have to be a fact question that the court would analyze to see what he knew, what he was deprived on, what he would have done differently had he had the complaint. It's a fact question that the court would have to look at in each case to see what type of harm occurred if due process were no longer protected by a rule like Gliazzo, which requires service in a manner reasonably calculated to give notice.
So the hospital got notice, but he got the summons. He didn't, and I'm not saying that that was a good thing. But he got the same benefits of representation that the hospital did because he had the same counsel, correct?
He did have the same counsel as his professional organization, Your Honor, correct. And he was able to utilize counsel and have counsel represent him. But the problem with the rule of replacing actual notice in place of service is that it opens the door to ambiguity and the possibility for real harm.
Isn't that what courts are here for, though? We don't make the rules unless it's civil procedure, and we still have to submit those to the legislature. But when it comes to the case law and justice, that's what we're here for, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor, and that's why in Gliazzo this court upheld the prior interpretation of Civil Rule 12 because it said that this rule is written to affect just results, and it does not favor the plaintiff or defendant. It favors those who abide by it. And this court is not going to overlook the rule to assist one who has failed to abide by it. This is a neutral rule which helps whoever favors it.
What about parties who take advantage of it? They find a loophole and then they drive a truck through it.
Your Honors, the
and waste court's time and resources in doing so, hurting other litigants.
It's not a loophole because it was clearly on the docket. The plaintiff and defendant had equal knowledge about the failed service, and the plaintiff had a number of tools at their disposal to resolve that. In terms of the efficiency of using the court's time to litigate, it would be less efficient under the appellant's rule because defendants would essentially be refusing to participate until the 1 year to serve or until they had served had passed, because otherwise they would have no way to preserve their affirmative defense. So some cases, the case schedule in Franklin County for non-professional torts is 1 year. The time to serve is 1 year. So if defendants aren't served for that entire year, they're not going to be participating in discovery, which is going to cause delay in the system.
But when you have, for instance, situations back in the early 2000s where foreclosure after foreclosure were filed and no one responded, the common thing that happens then is the plaintiff says if they think they have service, they file a motion for default judgment. If the court does its job right, the court says, no, you don't have service. So nothing, either at that point in time, there can be a dismissal of the action, or the plaintiff is going to go ahead and finally get service. So what's the difference?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Your Honor. I'm so sorry. What is the difference between a court looking at service and saying there is no service versus this case?
Well, I'm saying in terms of efficiency, you're saying that things could languish for a year in common pleas court when actually if there's no answer filed within that time, the defendant's either going to go and check service or they're going to file a motion for default judgment, and that motion should be denied if there's no service. So how does that lengthen the process? Because answer time is only 28 days.
I see, Your Honor. I apologize. So under the scenario I was explaining, the defendant would answer in order to still preserve their affirmative defense in the way the rules require. But then, unless the defendant had been served and plaintiffs are given an entire year, the defendants could not participate in discovery without giving up their affirmative defense and giving up their right to assert insufficient service. So it would be post-answer under that scenario.
Counsel, why should this court not adopt what the Sixth District has adopted and and it doesn't deny a defendant's right to assert this affirmative defense and recognizes it, but just looks at the timing and the participation that they seem to have, justice hasn't come to a screeching halt as a result. They've reinforced this in their case law, this interpretation. Why should this court not adopt the same?
The first reason, Your Honor, would be that there are two key differences between Ohio's rules of civil procedure and the federal's. The first, Ohio connects service to the commencement of the suit. The federal rules do not. Under the federal rules, you only have to file to commence, and under Ohio's rules, you have to file with service in 1 year. As a result, in Ohio, if the appellant's rule were adopted, there would be downstream effects of the courts not only having to determine whether there was enough participation, but when it occurred, to determine when the case was commenced and answer questions of priority. What was the first action? Statute of limitations and repose. Was it initiated within that time? Was a statute effective during this time? There's a whole host of downstream effects that happen in Ohio because we link service to commencement. Additionally, in the Sixth Circuit, they have struggled with this rule. And although the appellant points out that there are no post-King cases that struggle with the rule, King adopted the rule from Bolger, which is the rule they were struggling with. The rules in the federal court for waiver of personal jurisdiction and service are identical in the cases cited where federal courts were struggling. It's just the personal jurisdiction version, but it's precisely the same test that has no definitions set forth by the appellant for what level of participation will satisfy this. Your Honors, in sum, put frankly, this rule is working for Ohio, and this court already got it right in Gliazzo. It works for the plaintiffs who commence their suit by filing it within the statute of limitations and serving within a year. It works for defendants who know precisely how to preserve their defenses, but then participate in discovery just in case the case moves forward. It works for courts who have a predictable, certain, bright-line rule that they can apply in every case, and it works to affect justice because if the rule is followed, then the case will be heard on the merits, which is how every fair rule should operate. For that reason, this court should uphold Gliazzo once and for all. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Sesta, you have 44 minutes remaining for
seconds.
Your
44 minutes.
Seconds. Minutes, yeah.
I can give 44 you. Minutes, Your Honor. Thank you. A couple quick notes for the court. So as my colleague notes, the personal jurisdiction rules are treated identically to the service defenses, and with the exception that 12H1, so Rule 12H1 is the only way under Gliazzo for the service defenses to be waived, but the personal jurisdiction defenses under Maryhew are waivable by conduct of the defendant. So in the interest of treating those like defenses alike, I actually think our request is the correct one. And then the last thing I want to leave the court with is we just implore you to consider the incentive structure that we've created with Gliazzo. It has an unintended consequence, I think, of resulting in dismissal of cases when they should be decided on the merits. Overturning Gliazzo allows the correct incentive structure, resulting in trials on the merits.
Thank you.
Counsel,
appreciate it.
Let me ask
yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
If we do that, should we change Rule 41, eliminate it?
Your Honor, we're certainly not requesting a radical departure of
that's the, because the plaintiff in that case, under Rule 41, can go through all the depositions and hearings and the day before trial file Rule 41 dismissal, correct?
So I think the issue that we run into is the defendant isn't in a bind here, right? There's no need to file an answer and then participate thoroughly through the litigation if you haven't been served. If you haven't been served, there's been no trigger.
No, I'm asking a different question because what your arguments
Sorry, Your Honor.
Was activity and cost to the court and time.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm saying Rule 41A
okay.
permits the plaintiff, day before trial, mm-hmm. to dismiss the whole case no matter how many depositions been held and hearings and stuff, right?
Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
And so why wouldn't we have to get rid of that at the same time?
I think I come back to the idea of treating the civil rule 12B, 4, and 5 defenses identically to the personal jurisdiction defenses. Right? It's the same analysis in Maryhew as would be here. And Maryhew certainly didn't challenge the applicability of 41A.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will take the matter under advisement. You will receive a decision from the court.
Thank you.